in the interview with Robert Shoemaker, you were saying that this was only for the workers, not for the managers.
Not for the managers. And we, in these plants and mines overseas, we had no Americans involved except geologists that might visit once in a while, and then I would visit and work actually at those plants, but I reported to my boss in New York, and for instance, I spent 4 6-week periods each year in Norway for almost 5 years that I was at Union Carbide work on it, plus going to some of these other places. There's an interesting that happened about these one of these ore boats. The Vindefjord was owned partly by Norwegian American Lines and was operated by Norwegian American Lines. And the ore company decided to buy another ship. This Vindefjord, it was beautiful. It was painted snow white. And when they loaded manganese ore on it, the whole thing would be black, but within a day it would be polished and washed so that it looked like a liner, you know, rather than a passenger boat, rather than an ore carrying vessel. But they bought this other boat called Tontine. It was brand new. And it was owned 40% by the ore company and 40% by Norwegian American Lines and 20% by a Norwegian company which was owned by officers of Union Carbide as their private investment. They were allowed to buy pieces of this boat. And as soon as they took delivery on this boat, the bottom fell out of the shipping market. It fluctuates, you know, wildly. And they found it that it was that they could lease other boats cheaper than they could run the Tontine. So they, and this was also during the Cold War, and so they, which China was a part of, Red China, and so they leased this ship, which was about 20,000 tons capacity, they leased it to the Red Chinese, which was strictly against the United States government policies. But this 20% that was owned by the officers of Carbide, this was just a dummy company, and it was a Norwegian company, and the director and the owners didn't show up as directors of the company. So the Norwegian American Line had 40%, and they combined with this 20% ownership of them to make 60%, and therefore they could outvote the 40% that the ore company owned. And so they leased between that 60% ownership, they were the ones that could lease the boat to the Red Chinese. And the ore company naturally wrote a very, very strong letter to both the Norwegian American Lines and the 20% owned company, protesting use of or the leasing of this ship to the Red Chinese, and that got them off the hook, you see. Actually, it was interesting. We couldn't, when I would go to Norway, and I kept my paperwork to an absolute minimum, reports, because this was, it was a Norwegian company, and it was run by Norwegians, and yet we owned it.
This is the company that ran the Faroe Islands,
yeah,
not the shipping company.
This, the company in Norway that was called Electric Furnace Products Company.
Okay.
And then we had another one called Meraker, M-E-R-A-K-E-R, Smelteverk, and I can't give you the exact spelling of, I think it's Smelteverk. And theoretically, we couldn't tell the Norwegians what to do. We wanted to keep it arm's length. And once a year, carbide lawyers would come into our offices, and there were only about 25 of us in this company, including the mailboy in New York, and they would go through our files, and anything that they didn't like, they would just throw into a big box and take it away and burn it. Because they didn't want the government to come in prowling around and seeing that we were actually doing any directing of these companies. It was something to do with taxes, and I don't know what it was, but they would come in and just, the word decimate today is misused badly, because it means only 10%. But they decimated my files by about 30% every year, maybe even 50%. Getting back to that tontine, it was very funny, because the first voyage of the tontine, the front end of the ship was loaded with wheat, and the back end was loaded with automobiles. And
this was going from Norway to Ghana.
No, this was the one that we released to the Chinese.
Okay.
And it went down through the Suez Canal and out into the Red Sea. It ran onto a rock that was in the middle of the Red Sea that no one knew about, and then this thing was right in the shipping lanes and had been there for 100 years. And no one had ever run onto it before. Hmm. And it was stuck on the rock for over 3 months. And they dumped all the wheat overboard, and all the automobiles were dumped overboard, and they finally got the thing free. But they were afraid that the whole thing would sink in a big storm. They later went in and put some divers down there and blasted that rock out of the way.
For heaven's sake.
But it was a...
It really was a rock then.
It really was quite a good-sized rock.
For heaven's sake.
I said 3 months. It took them 4 months to get that thing off the rock. But it's strange how big companies work. You know, they weren't doing anything that was strictly illegal, but they didn't want it to appear being anywhere near illegal. Mm-hmm. And that's why the lawyers would come in, and I suppose they did the same to Union Carbide International, which owned a lot of chemical plants and other types of plants in other other countries, including the one in India that killed so many people. I think that was a horrible mistake because...
This is Bhopal.
Yeah. I wouldn't trust the Indians to run a plant like that. I wouldn't trust a lot of countries to run a plant like that. They, all by themselves. I think it's a terrible thing.
Turned out to be a mistake.
I wanted to tell a little bit about a fellow we had. We put in a manganese nodulizing kiln, which is my idea. I converted an old lime kiln over in Norway to nodulize manganese ore fines, because the furnaces, manganese ore is very soft and makes a lot of dust in the furnace, and this furnace, this dust will cave in into the electric furnace and after it builds up on the sides and creates explosions. And I had the idea of putting these fines into a rotary kiln and getting them hot enough so they stuck together and made nodules the size of baseballs.
Is this similar to pelletizing?
In a way, but the pellets are generally 5/8 of an inch.
They are.
And they are made in a different type of furnace. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the one in Norway works so well. Then we put the one in Newport News, and we got a man by the name of Homer Hutchison, who had been a master mechanic in a mine in the Philippines and was captured and was in the Santa Tomas prison camp during the war. he was a mechanical genius, and he built a radio by himself in that prison camp and was able to listen to American broadcasts. He was so valuable, they wanted to keep him, and the Japanese kept trying to send him back to Japan, or to Japan. And finally, they told him he had to go the next day, and so there was a doctor there that operated on Hutch without any anesthetic and took his appendix out. Mm. And so they couldn't take him. Mm. That was a ship that got sunk by the Americans. Anyway, after the war, he went to work in New Caledonia at our chrome mine down there, and then was brought back to the United States and worked in Rifle, Colorado, in the uranium mines, and then came and worked in at Newport News. He became a very close friend of mine, and he invented more innovations in materials handling equipment than you can almost think of. I had first met him when I was over in Australia for Union Carbide Ore Company, which I've related in my memoirs. And when I left the, when I was ready to leave Australia, my boss at Union Carbide Ore Company asked me to go to our mine in New Caledonia and take a look at it. And it was run by an Englishman but it was New Caledonia at that time was still controlled by the French. And it seemed like they did an awful lot of drilling over there, but they never found any ore, any more ore, and the reserves were getting quite small. And so they finally decided that since I was over in Australia, they would send me over there to stop by and take a visit. And it was quite labor intensive, but that wasn't the whole problem. They could have, if they'd invested money in labor-saving devices, they could have made more money. But anyway, I met the manager, who was an Englishman, and he was saying that he was going to out and locate a new exploration hole. The next day, I asked if I'd like to go along with him. And so I said, sure. And so I went out the next morning with him, and he got out of his the Land Rover that he was driving, and I was riding in. And he had a couple of welding rods that he had bent in form of an L-shaped on a right angle, and he started walking around with his welding rods
like a dowser.
And eventually, after half an hour, he said, "This is the spot where our new drill hole is going to be." Well, he'd been doing this all the time. He had never had a geologist on the staff. He'd never hired a geologist. He did his dowsing, but he never found any more ore. So I went back to New York, and I told my boss, Tom Meek, about that. And so they removed him and got a new manager for the mine.
Did they find more ore then?
Yes, they did.
With a different method.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Hutchison, had this one about Hutchison. He's dead now, but when he was working in Rifle, he liked to drink a lot, and but not on the job, but he would drink it up at night. And he went to a party one night, and a few days later, this man came to the door, and he says, "I've got your organ outside." He said, "Where do you want it?" And he said, Hutch said, "What organ?" And he said, "Well," he said, "the one you ordered from me the other night at the party." Well, Hutch didn't remember it at all, but he'd always wanted to play an organ, so he told the man to bring it in. And his wife, who could play the piano, she taught Hutch how to play the organ. And down in Newport News, he had it hooked up to 12 different speakers in his house. And he would play the organ, and the plant superintendent and I'd go down there, and we would drink Kentucky Gentleman out of jelly glasses. And because that's the only kind of glasses they had. They were very casual in their housekeeping. And he would play the organ, and you could hear it all over the place. But people didn't mind because he played so well.
Well, that was good.
Another mine we had was in South Africa. It was a chromium or chromite mine. And Spedden was my boss had gone to the South Africa and he visited this mine, and they had just installed a heavy media plant for separation of the waste from the ore. And a heavy media plant is, they were using very finely ground ferrosilicon mixed with water to give a slurry of a specific gravity of around 2.8 to 3, which means 2.8 to 3 times the specific gravity of water. And the chrome ore would sink in this slurry. The slurry was kept agitated all the time. And the most of the waste material was composed of kaolin clay, which was extremely light. It had a gravity of specific gravity of say maybe 2.0, so it was a very, very simple separation job. The only thing was, the plant wasn't working. because the kaolin would, being so very soft, would grind up the slurry would become extremely viscous. Well, this would happen with most any ore, but it happened particularly with this because the kaolin was so soft. And the plant was, the chrome ore would sink, but the part of it would sink. And a lot of the kaolin would sink with it, and a lot of the chrome ore would float, and a lot of along with the kaolin, and it just was a mess. And so Spedden had the idea that he could decrease the viscosity of this slurry. And make the plant work. And so he came back, he brought samples with him and came back to Niagara Falls. And this was when, I don't think we should mention his name, but we have mentioned it before. He was working there and taking my place. And they experimented trisodium phosphate, which is a dispersing agent, and it lowered the viscosity of this solution or this slurry, so that the heavy media plant would work properly. I was in South Africa shortly after this, and I went out to the plant, this chrome plant.
Where was it?
It was north the Transvaal, north of Johannesburg, 150 miles or so.
Okay.
And the heavy media plant, the sink product mixed with ferrosilicon and the float product mixed with ferrosilicon go out of this drum that the separation is made in, and the two products go onto screens, and the first part of the screen is the ferrosilicon goes through and drains, they call that the drain section of the screen, and it is pumped directly back to the separation drum. But then the ferrosilicon has to be washed off of both the sink and the float, the chromite and the gangue mineral. And so the second part of the screen is called the wash screen, and they spray water on it, and on the ore that goes across the screen, and the ore is washed clean with ferrous silicon, and then goes, this slurry, dilute slurry, goes to a magnetic separator, which removes the non-magnetic gang material from the magnetic ferrosilicon. And then the ferrosilicon goes into what we call a spiral classifier, which is used as a densifier and removes the water, enough water to bring the specific gravity of the slurry back up to what is required in the separation drum. And underneath the screens, there is a launder that is that can be moved along underneath the screen to either increase or decrease the amount of material going directly back to the drum and the drain, or the amount of increase or decrease the amount of ore that goes to the wash section of the screen. And this launder is on rails, and you crank it along with the crank to get the right ratio of sink and of drain and wash. Well, we went out, this manager was telling me how great this idea was of using, that Spedden had of using trisodium phosphate to decrease the viscosity of the ferrosilicon slurry. And he had just bought a very large tonnage. The way he explained it was about a quarter of the shipload. And the plant was working quite well. But I noticed that the this launder had been moved all the way forward, and so there was very little of this slurry of ferrosilicon and kaolin that was getting into the wash section and going through the magnetic separator and the densifier. And I asked him why he operated this thing so with these launders so far forward. And he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, you see this crank here, it moves this launder back and forth and puts more of the ferrosilicon into the wash section, which gets rid of the kaolin in the magnetic separator, and helps and it prevents the buildup of the fine kaolin. And I said, this thing is clear forward, and you have nothing going through the cleaning circuit, and virtually everything going back to the drum. And why don't we move this launder back to where it should be? And he says, well, that's what it's for. And so I moved these two launders back to about the midpoint there, and then I asked him to cut off the feed of this sodium polyphosphate, or trisodium phosphate. And the plant ran without any trisodium phosphate, and it ran perfectly. And he said, what am I going to do with all this trisodium phosphate? He said, I got a quarter of a shipload of it. And I said, well, that's not my worry, that's yours. And, but you certainly don't need it. Well, Spedden and his assistant were writing a paper on this use of trisodium phosphate to reduce the viscosity of the media in the heavy media plant, and I didn't say anything about it. But Spedden at that time was down in New York too. We moved to New York at the same time to go to work for the ore company, and he heard about it from my boss, and they had to cancel the publication of the paper. And Spedden wasn't very happy with me.
I'm sure not.
I was continually doing things that got me into trouble. But my boss always got me,
Who was your boss?
Tom Meek. He was a
W-E-K.
Yeah, wonderful man, and he let me do anything I wanted to do, because he knew I always made money for the company. after being with the ore company for almost 5 years, I could see that we were going to be absorbed by the Union Carbide Metals Company, and I went back decided that I would like to get back west. I'd been in the east for over 12 years, and one day a man from Bechtel came to see me and asked if I'd be interested in going to work for them. He had heard about me through a friend of mine. And so I did. I was very much encouraged by my boss. He said if he was younger, he would have gone too. Mm-hmm. If I had gone with the Union Carbide Metals Company, I would have been a very small frog in a large pond, instead of a big frog in a little pond.
Just a second.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
When I was at Bechtel, I was elected president of the Mining and Metallurgical Society of America. I was elected president of the Mining and Metallurgical Society of America. And the MMSA was established in 1908 by a group of prominent people in the mining industry. And actually, because of the efforts of the MMSA during those early days, the U.S. Bureau of Mines was established. And it was almost like an honorary society. But it had been very active in most of its years, but it became kind of dormant in the 50s. I had been a member of it in New York, and when I got to San Francisco, I decided to see if I could start a San Francisco section of the MMSA, which I did, and it became quite successful. It's still in existence, and it is probably and it is more active than by far, and has far more members than the New York section did, even at its peak. of the mining people, mining houses that moved out of New York. And anyway, I also got a directory published, which is still being published. And it has a biography of each one of the members in it, and it is quite valuable.
Wonderful resource.
Yeah. And during the 2 years I was president, I nominated and was very privileged to award Plato Malazimov the Mining and Metallurgical Society Gold Medal, which they occasionally award to some very, very distinguished person in the mining industry. And because Newmont had, under Plato, had established the Carlin gold mine in 1964, when I was chief metallurgical engineer at Bechtel, and we built the plant, designed and built it in 10 months, I thought the gold that was in this metal should come from Carlin. And so I talked to the manager of the Carlin mine, and
who was that?
The name was Jay Macbeth, MCBETH, who was a good friend of mine. And so Macbeth sent 10 ounces of gold to Tiffany's in New York, who had the dyes for this, to stamp this metal with. And shortly afterwards, I got a call from Tiffany's saying that they couldn't melt this gold. It turned into little globules that wouldn't coalesce.
It's granulating.
And they were kind of frantic. And it was really very pure gold. Mm-hmm. And so I called my friend over, who was chief chemist over there, whose name was Harry Treweek. Mm-hmm. Treweek, Treweek. He was a Cornishman. And he said, he says, there's no problem with that. He says, that is caused by 3 or 4 parts per million of chromium that is in our gold. And it causes the surface tension of the gold to increase. And it forms little tiny globules when you melt it, and the cure for that is to melt it with a borax cover, borax poured over the gold in the crucible, and he said you won't have any problem. And speaking of Plato, I became quite well acquainted with Plato and in New York, and I would see him at the mining club occasionally, and would see him in his office occasionally too when I was over visiting with Frank and Quiston. When we built Carlin, after it was built, they had a dedication ceremony, because that was the first gold plant that had been built in over 30 years in the United States. And Plato was there to give a speech, and they had the governor there, and Steve Bechtel Sr. was invited, and he flew in a company plane over there, and I was there also. And Plato was put up at the Stockman's Hotel in Elko. And the Stockman's Hotel is unfortunately located right alongside the railroad tracks. They've been moved since then. But the suite that they put Plato in was had a window that just had the railroad tracks just right alongside of it. And Plato didn't get any sleep at all. They were switching trains through there all night long. And Plato was supposed to stay there for 2 days. But after the ceremony was over, and Plato had given his speech, he asked Steve Sr. if he could go to San Francisco in Steve's plane so he could get back to New York there. Mm-hmm. And which Steve Sr. was very happy to do. Strangely enough, Plato never returned to the Carlin plant.
Really?
Not ever in his life did he return to the Carlin plant. And yet that is the
star in their crown.
Yes. In fact, now it is, you know, they've recombined Newmont Mining with Newmont Gold, and it's all one company again. They're not in any other business but gold.
It's one of the major producers in the world, that mine, isn't it?
It's, yeah, it's one of the very big ones in the world.
Uh-huh. But he didn't like the Stockman's Hotel.
No, he certainly didn't.
Do you know how that's spelled? Is it stock singular or plural? M-A-N plural. Or M-E-N?
No, it's singular. Stockman's.
M-A-N. Okay. Well.
Speaking of Bechtel airplanes, we had two of them, and they were called Lockheed Lodestars. They were Lockheed Lodestars and were also the Lear conversion of the original Lodestar, which made them faster. They had little bigger engines and. And they had more streamlining. Bechtel had two of them at Oakland Airport and the third one at Westchester, New York. And when Steve Sr. still ran the company, business came first with those airplanes. And as chief metallurgical engineer, if I wanted to take a crew of people someplace to work on a plant or even see a plant, I could get one of those airplanes to do that. And that was also true when they traded them in on turboprop Grumman Gulfstreams. But those were eventually traded in on French Falcon jets when Steve Jr. took over, and at that time I couldn't even attempt to get one of those airplanes. They were used entirely for taking clients fishing and taking and hunting trips or golfing trips, and also taking on vice presidents along with those people.
Mm-hmm. This might be a good place for you to talk a little bit about Steve Sr. and his business ethics.
Oh, okay, we'll do that. Well, let's take a break for a minute.
Well, let's talk about Steve Bechtel Sr.
All right. Steve Bechtel Sr., of course, his father started the company. I can't remember when it started, but his name was W.A. Bechtel.
Warren, I think.
Warren. There was also a Warren, a son by the name of Warren, who was a brother to Steve Sr., who worked for the company too, but then he was more interested in other things, and they Bechtel started an insurance company, and so Warren Bechtel, that is the son, took over the insurance company, and then this insurance company became Factory Mutual.
Which one?
Factory Mutual, and which later became, well, it still has that name, and they, I got my automobile insurance when I was with Carbide with Factory Mutual, because they gave Carbide people a discount. And I still have it, but it's called Automobile Mutual now. Anyway, Steve Sr. Was one of the most honest people in the world, and he was very, very ethical and wanted all of his people to be very ethical. And he was extremely well respected by people all over the world. He had a great memory for names, and he surrounded himself with people who were very, very fine engineers, although there was one fellow who was a vice president, a senior vice president by the name of Jerry Comas, K-O-M-A-S, who had only got as far as the ninth grade. And yet, he was one of the very senior people at Bechtel. And it was said that Bechtel never tried to influence people with money, like the bribe. I can remember being in New York at an AIME convention, and the Mining and Metallurgical Society has a luncheon meeting at every AIME convention. And I was sitting next to George Monroe, who at that time was president of Phelps Dodge. And the speaker that day was Ralph M. Parsons, who at one time had been associated with the Bechtels. Originally, the company was called W.A. Bechtel and Sons, and then it became John J. McClone. Was it McClone or McCombe? He later headed up the CIA.
McClone.
It became Bechtel, McClone, Parsons. Ralph Parsons was that Parsons. Parsons was, he was a very flamboyant type, and he didn't, although the Parsons was in on the building of the Hoover Dam with the Beckles, they were one of the big six. Anyway, they didn't get along too well, and so Parsons left and formed his own company, which became quite successful.
Now there's the Ralph Lynn Parsons Company, and then there's also Parsons Jordan. Are they the same?
They're not the same.
They're different, aren't
yeah.
they?
Mm-hmm.
So he started what was
Ralph M. Parsons.
Ralph M. Parsons.
No, I'm sorry, Parsons Jordan. I was thinking of Parsons Brinkerhoff.
Parsons Brinkerhoff. Okay.
Company is still in existence, and they are not related. But Ralph M. Parsons took over. I think it was called Jordan Associates, and Jordan was the chief engineer of Anaconda.
Mm-hmm.
And when Anaconda decided to give up their own engineering department, it was so large that they built, designed and built plants for other copper companies. They sold, Anaconda sold the their engineering department to Jordan for a dollar. And he formed Jordan Associates along with some of his top people. And became quite successful, and then he got ready to retire, so he sold out to Parsons, and then it became Parsons Jordan. At least that part of the mining and metals part of it became Parsons Jordan. Anyway, that day at that meeting, Ralph M. Parsons was the speaker, and he was a very short man. He couldn't have been over 5'1" or 5'2" at the most. And they had to scurry around and find a box for him to stand on so he could look over the podium at the audience. And there was, probably 125 people there. And he was supposed to talk about dealing, about doing engineering and construction overseas. And he started out very well, but then he digressed and mentioned that that occasionally he would have to pay bribes to people overseas, customs people and other types of people. And then he couldn't get off the subject, and he went on and on and on about how to bribe people. And I was just embarrassed, working for Bechtel, to listen to that. And finally, this George Monroe leaned over to me, and he says, "I will never give Parsons $1 worth of work." And he says, "After this," he said, "it's the worst thing I've ever heard." I don't think Bechtel was involved to that extent, and you certainly have to have certain people that are lawyers and so on, that are well connected in foreign countries. And you may have had, and Bechtel may have had to give money to other people, but I've never heard of it. The only two instances I ever heard of was an iron ore company that we built a plant for in Canada. And there was, they were, when the thing was being constructed, they had an awful lot of labor trouble. And it was a union job, and the owner of the plant was approached by one of the officers of the union, and who asked for money to so that they wouldn't have, the union wouldn't cause any more trouble. And the owner didn't want Bechtel, or didn't want to get involved themselves, so they asked the construction superintendent if he would give the money to the union man. And he agreed to it. So the owner gave a very substantial amount of money to the construction superintendent, who gave it to the union officer. And somehow the word got out, and when Steve Sr. heard about it, even though the man was a very senior construction superintendent, Steve Sr. just fired him out of hand. He wouldn't tolerate. There was another one that I'd heard about. I didn't know anything about the plant. I think it was a pipeline back in the east. And the same thing happened. And the owner of that pipeline asked the Bechtel's construction superintendent to give this money to a union representative to stop the problems they were having with the union employees, construction employees. And the word got out on that, and Steve Sr. again fired this man right out of hand, even though he was a very old and trusted friend of his. Mm-hmm. I don't, some companies I do know, some engineering firms like to work for the government. Government installations overseas. Some of them really specialize in that. Bechtel never liked to work for the government after World War II. Occasionally the government would come around and say, you got to submit a bid on this little bitty job, just to keep the other people honest, and Bechtel would take it. But U.S. government work was a very small fraction of 1% of their work. They did not like to work for the government. There were government people asking for bribes. And Bechtel could get along perfectly well without doing any government work. They worked for quasi-government and governmental agencies like utility districts. Like some utilities are owned, you know, by cities, or they work for irrigation districts and put in dams. But those weren't they didn't like to work for either the state or the federal government.
Did they do AEC work?
I don't. Oh. I don't think so. If it was very little, very little. Of course, they were very big in the atomic power business. And, of course, they would buy the units themselves, the reactors themselves from Westinghouse or GE, or I guess there were others, Babcock and Wilcox. But they haven't, there hasn't been a nuclear power plant built in a great many years, as you well know, which is absolutely ridiculous, because they're perfectly safe. A Three Mile Island plant, Bechtel went in and cleaned that up, by the way. But no one ever got hurt from that. No one got sick. It never affected anyone.
They still call it a disaster.
And the environmentalists are still calling it a disaster. Right. The Chernobyl plant really killed a very small number of people compared to what the environmentalists claim. But the nuclear power plants that we have built are so much safer, and now they've developed even ones that are just these breeder reactors. They make their own fuel, you know, and there isn't anything left over, and now the government has permitted some companies to build two power plants, nuclear power plants in China. 75% of France's power is provided by nuclear plants. And when uranium is an absolutely useless metal, except for making nuclear power. Many years ago, they used to use it, a little bit of it in pigments, and it had a yellow color. but it's absolutely useless for anything else today. And yet, the government wants to us to burn natural gas, which has it is non-renewable, it is necessary in the plastics industry, completely necessary. Yet they want us to burn more natural gas in power plants. And over in Reno, they just now approved this new gambling casino that has got structure like an oil rig where they drill for oil, you know, but with a gas flame coming out of the top of it about 60 feet high, I think.
Burning all the time?
It's burning all the time.
Polluting the air and everything else.
It's relatively clean. It's clean burning, although, of course, the way that is burned, that's a red flame that is making, that's carbon particles that are red hot. And when gas burns efficiently, it has a blue flame like in your gas stove. But to destroy these coal and I think we should save the coal for our future generations, for the for the chemicals that are available from coal. And of course, we got a lot more coal than we have natural gas, for that matter. But then after that, then they have tar sands and oil shales. And that brings me to the next subject.
Well, we kind of got back, got off from the, you did tell an interesting little anecdote earlier about dealing in Iran. Do you want to mention that now?
About
what? About an experience you had in Iran.
Oh.
Apropos of Bechtel's.
Yeah, I went, I was sent to Iran with four Bechtel vice presidents. We were after, we wanted to get, hopefully be able to build a very large copper plant that the government of Iran wanted to, that was during the time of the Shah, wanted to build. And we didn't get the contract. One of the vice presidents was a financial man, and he had met a man who was part of one of the big families there in Iran that owned so much of the country and so much of the industry, very closely connected with the Shah. And we had an appointment to see him. The night before, we were in the cocktail lounge of the Intercontinental Hotel, and which was the only place that you could buy a drink, I think, in Iran. And all the Iranian elite came in there for drinks.